This deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 24 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at CertFuel.com.
Definitely check them out.
Yeah. So picture this. Imagine a rogue trader at your firm just lost millions of dollars in client funds on, I don't know, incredibly risky, unapproved meme stock options.
Total nightmare scenario.
Right. The clients are furious, the media is calling, and the SEC is literally knocking on your door looking for someone to pay a $25 million fine. And because you are the registered principal of this firm, they are looking directly at you.
Yeah, they are not looking at the trader. They're looking at the boss.
Exactly. So today, our mission is to make sure that scenario never, ever happens to you. We are conquering the Series 24 exam, and I am talking directly to you, the listener. Right now, I know what your goal is. You don't just want to like memorize a bunch of dry, dusty regulations just to brain dump them the second you walk out of the testing center.
Right. You want to actually understand the mechanics under the hood. Because, I mean, the Series 24, the General Securities Principle exam, it fundamentally tests your judgment as a leader. Fine ROA and the SEC want to know if you can actually run a broker-dealer and, you know, keep everyone out of federal prison.
Which is a pretty good goal to have. Keeping people out of prison.
Highly recommended.
So we are tossing out the dry lecture format. No reading a textbook today. We're using this massive high-yield cheat sheet covering all five functions of the exam, but we're going to look at the underlying logic. Like when you sit down for the test, if you understand why a rule exists, you can deduce the answer even if you've totally forgotten the specific flashcard.
Exactly. The logic is everything.
And to make this stick in your brain, especially if your attention span works like mine and you just tune out the second you hear the word regulation, we are bringing these rules to life. We've got a cast of recurring characters. And throughout this deep dive, we're basically going to subject these poor people to every regulatory nightmare imaginable.
It's going to get rough for them.
So rough. First up, we have Broker Bob. Bob is the founder. He's enthusiastic, well-meaning, like a great guy to get a beer with. But Bob is fundamentally disorganized. He is basically a walking compliance violation.
Which is exactly why Bob relies entirely on our second character, compliance Kathy.
Oh, poor Kathy.
Yeah, Kathy is the stressed out, hyper-vigilant supervisor. She drinks way too much coffee. She probably hasn't slept a full 8 hours since, what, 2018?
The least.
And she views her entire job as desperately trying to keep Bob's firm from being shut down by the government.
And then finally, we have the villain of our story, Devious Dave. Dave is a top-producing rogue trader who views FINRA rules as polite suggestions for lesser mortals.
He's the worst. Dave is our prime example of exactly what not to do.
100%. So, quick vibe check for you, the listener. Stay on your toes today. We are going to throw direct questions at you. We'll give you a beat to think, and we will explicitly call out exam traps. When you hear us say exam trap, that is your cue to lock in.
Lock in and take notes.
So let's start at the absolute foundation, building the firm. Function one, Broker Bob wants to open his doors. But before he even files a single piece of paper, he has to decide what kind of business he's actually running, a broker or a dealer. Because, you know, people smash them together into broker-dealer, but those are two very different legal hats.
They really are. They are completely different risk profiles for the firm. Let's look at the mechanism here. When Bob acts as a broker, he is acting as an agent. He's simply facilitating a trade between two other people, right? And he takes a commission for making that introduction.
So if we use like a real estate analogy, a broker is just a standard real estate agent. If I want to sell my house, the agent doesn't write me a check and buy it themselves. They just list it, find a buyer, connect us, and take a percentage.
Exactly.
They take zero market risk on my house. If the housing market crashes while it's listed, the agent isn't losing their own money because they don't own the house.
That's the perfect way to look at it. Zero market risk for the firm's capital. But if Bob acts as a dealer, he is putting on his principal hat. He is trading from his firm's own inventory, using his firm's own capital.
So in our analogy, the dealer is the house flipper. Bob sees my house, thinks it's undervalued, and buys it with his own cash. It goes onto Bob's balance sheet. He puts it in his inventory and then tries to sell it to someone else for a markup. But if the housing market crashes while Bob is holding that house,
Bob eats the loss.
Bob eats the loss.
And that right there is why the regulators care so deeply about which hat you were wearing. A dealer takes on massive risk to their own capital. If a dealer makes bad bets, the firm goes bankrupt, which causes, you know, huge systemic shockwaves. So whether Bob is acting as an agent taking commissions or a principal charging markups, what is the golden rule before he starts trading?
he cannot touch a single client dollar until he registers with the SEC. It's a three-tier system, right? Yep. Federal, self-regulatory, and state.
It is entirely mandatory. Interstate commerce triggers federal jurisdiction. Bob has to register at the federal level with the SEC, at the self-regulatory organization level, which is almost always FANRA, and at the state level with the local administrators.
I'm assuming he doesn't just like write a letter to the SEC chairman and say, hey, I'm open for business. What is the actual central nervous system for all this paperwork?
The Central Registration Depository, the CRD, it is the master database. Bob files Form BD, which is the master application to build a broker-dealer.
BD for build.
Right. And if he expands and opens a branch office across town, he files Form BR for branch registration. And if the stress gets to be too much and he just wants to shut the whole firm down, he files Form BDW to withdraw.
Okay, so BD to build, BR for branch, BDW to withdraw. But I want to pause on the FANRA part of this for a second. Filing Form BD doesn't magically grant you a FANRA membership.
Yeah.
FANRA is essentially a private club. You have to pass the bouncer.
Oh, yeah. The bouncer is the new member application, the NMA. MNRA holds Bob to 14 very strict standards. They audit his capital, his computer systems, his background, his supervisory structure. It takes months. But here's the thing that catches a lot of principals out on the exam. FANRA scrutiny does not end once you get approved.
Right, because Bob might get the firm approved when it's literally just him and Kathy in a rented office.
Right.
But 3 years later, business is booming, and Bob decides he wants to sell a massive chunk of his firm to an outside private equity group. Listener, this is an exam trap call out. If Bob changes his firm's ownership, can he just shoot FANRA a quick email to update the file? Give it a second to think.
He absolutely cannot. If Bob undergoes an ownership change of 25% or more, or if he fundamentally shifts his business model, say he was just doing mutual funds and now he wants to be like a high frequency market maker, that triggers a continuing membership application or CMA.
That 25% threshold is the magic number to memorize. It basically tells FANRA, hey, the people running this firm are totally different now. You need to revet us. Now, let's say Bob gets completely fed up with the whole CMA process. He hates the paperwork. He files Form BDW to withdraw, packs his bags, and moves to a quiet beach in Mexico to drink margaritas. He's totally out of the industry. Does FINRA immediately lose jurisdiction over him?
Nope. FINRA has a very long memory. This is the 2-year tail rule. FINRA retains jurisdiction over the firm and over its registered personnel for 2 full years after the withdrawal is officially effective.
Wow. So if FINRA gets a tip 6 months after Bob moves to Mexico that he was running a massive Ponzi scheme right before he closed up shop, they can still drag him into an enforcement proceeding.
They can investigate him, fine him, and permanently bar him from the industry. You cannot outrun FINRA for 24 months.
2 years. Good to know. Okay, let's look at this from the customer's perspective. Bob's firm has custody of millions of dollars of client money. The clients want to know their money is safe. This brings us to SIPC, the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. I have a direct question for you, the listener. Let's say Bob's top trader, Devious Days, picks some absolutely terrible tech stocks, just garbage companies with zero revenue. Dave's clients lose half of their net worth because the stock market totally tanks. Does SIPC step in and bail those clients out? Take a beat.
The answer is no.
Never.
Not a dime. Not a dime. And you will see this disguised a dozen different ways on the exam. To understand why, you have to look at why SIPC was created back in 1970. Back then, broker dealers were going bankrupt left and right, and clients were losing their money not because their actual stocks went down, but because the firm holding the stocks collapsed and the assets just vanished in the bankruptcy. SIPC was created as an insurance policy against the firm's failure, not against market risk.
It's like a parking garage. If I pay a garage to hold my Ferrari and the garage goes bankrupt and the owner skips town with my car, I want insurance to replace my car. That's SIPC. But if I drive my Ferrari out of the garage and crash it into a brick wall, that's market risk. The garage isn't paying for that.
Exactly. SIPC provides up to $500,000 of coverage per separate customer, of which no more than $250,000 can be for missing cash. But that coverage only kicks in if the broker-dealer goes under and the assets are literally missing from the vault. If your portfolio drops 90% because you bought bad stocks, that is entirely your problem.
SIPC covers broker-dealer failure, not bad investment choices. Got it. So let's move on to the actual humans working at the firm. Bob needs to hire a staff. The regulatory term is associated persons.
Mm.
And the exam loves to test the boundaries of who actually needs to be registered with FANRA.
An associated person is basically anyone controlled by the firm, officers, directors, employees. But being an associated person doesn't automatically mean you have to sit down and take a licensing exam.
Okay, direct question for the listener. Bob decides to hire his cousin. The cousin comes into the office on weekends to sweep the floors, empty the shredding bins, and fix the Wi-Fi router. The cousin never talks to clients, never sees an account statement, and never touches a trade. Does Bob's cousin need to register with FunRI?
He does not. You have to apply the two-tier test here. Tier one, is he an associated person? Yes, he's an employee of the firm. Tier two, does he engage in the securities business? No. His functions are purely clerical and ministerial. Fixing Wi-Fi does not involve securities.
But let's say the receptionist is at lunch. The phones are ringing off the hook. The cousin picks up the phone just to be helpful, and a client says, hey, I need to buy 100 shares of Apple right now.
Yeah.
The cousin writes it down on a sticky note and says, sure thing, I'll make sure it gets done. What just happened?
Bob just earned himself a massive compliance violation. Accepting a customer order is never considered a clerical function. The moment the cousin accepted that order, he engaged in the securities business without a license.
Because the person taking the order is supposed to be capable of understanding it, verifying the client's identity, and ensuring it's not some massive error, right? A guy who just fixes the Wi-Fi doesn't know how to do that.
Precisely. And this is exactly where Compliance Kathy steps in, because it is her job to manage the registration paperwork for the people who actually do engage in the securities business.
Let's talk about Kathy's paperwork deadlines. When Bob hires a new broker, Kathy files Form U-4 on the CRD to register them. The U-4 is basically their permanent industry resume. What kind of history does Kathy have to dig up on a new hire?
She has to report 5 years of their residential history, so where they lived, and 10 years of their employment history. And they have to account for every single month. If there is a three-month gap where they were unemployed, that has to be explicitly stated.
Okay, 5 years of housing, 10 years of jobs. But what happens when someone leaves? Let's say Bob finally gets sick of Devious Dave's antics and fires him.
Then Kathy must file Form U-5 to terminate Dave's registration, and the deadline for the U-5 is 30 days. Within 30 days of termination, she has to file the U-5, and she has to provide a physical copy to Dave.
And the U-5 isn't just a basic, he doesn't work here anymore form, is it?
Yeah.
You have to state the exact reason for termination. So if he was fired for fraud, Kathy has to write that down, which effectively torpedoes Dave's chance of getting hired anywhere else.
That's the entire point of the CRD system. It prevents bad actors from just hopping from firm to firm without a paper trail following them.
Speaking of bad actors, let's explore the darkest corner of registration. Statutory disqualification. This is essentially the industry's death penalty. Imagine Dave is out at a bar on a Friday night, he gets into a massive brawl, steals a police horse, and rides it through a plate glass window. He is arrested and convicted of a felony. Just straight up Grand Theft Equine.
That is quite the visual.
Right. But it has absolutely nothing to do with finance or stocks. Does this impact his FunRI license?
It absolutely ends it. The rules for statutory disqualification are rigid. Any felony conviction whatsoever within the past 10 years disqualifies you. It does not matter if it was financial in nature. If it's a felony, you are out.
Wow. What if you pled it down to a misdemeanor? Like misdemeanor destruction of property.
Then he survives. For misdemeanors, FunRI only cares if it is securities or money related. So embezzlement, extortion, fraud, bribery. A misdemeanor traffic violation or a misdemeanor bar fight does not trigger a statutory disqualification.
But her boy Dave got the felony. Kathy finds out on Monday morning. Does she have the standard 30 days to update his Form U-4 just like she would for a U-5?
Exam trap? Absolutely not. If a registered rep triggers a statutory disqualification, the firm only has 10 days to file an amendment to their Form U-4. Just 10 days. The regulators want to know immediately if a convicted felon is managing client money.
10 days. Wow. So Dave is statutorily disqualified. Is his career in finance 100% permanently over? Is there any loophole where Bob, who loves Dave's commission revenue, can keep him on the desk?
I mean, there is a process, but calling it a loophole makes it sound easy. It is agonizingly difficult. Bob's firm would have to file Form MC-400, which stands for Membership Continuance. They are literally begging FunRI to let Dave stay.
And FunRI doesn't just say, oh, sure, if you promise he'll be good.
No, absolutely not. Bob has to submit a comprehensive, rigid plan of heightened supervision. Kathy essentially has to sit physically next to Dave, review every single phone call, read every email before it goes out, and sign off on every trade ticket. And even then, the National Adjudicatory Council, the NAC, has to review the application and approve it. The NAC rejects these all the time because the burden on the firm to actually execute that level of supervision is usually way too high.
Heightened supervision means Kathy's life becomes a waking nightmare, basically. Okay, that wraps up function one, building the firm. We know the difference between a broker and a dealer. We know the 25% ownership sugar for a CMA. We know SIPC covers firm failure, not market risk. We have our 30-day window for Form U5 and our 10-day panic window for a statutory disqualification on a U4. Let's step into part two, keeping the doors open. This is broker-dealer supervision function two. This is the meat of the exam, making up about a third of your questions.
Supervision is all about preventing Dave from doing something that bankrupts the firm. And the foundation of all supervision is the WSPS, the Written Supervisory Procedures. This is a massive document that details exactly who is responsible for what. Every firm must establish, maintain, and enforce a supervisory system that is specifically tailored to their business.
Meaning, if Bob runs a three-person shop doing mutual funds, his WSP shouldn't look like a 5,000-page manual stolen from J.P. Morgan. It has to be scaled to his actual size and risk.
Right. And having the manual is only step one. Step two is inspecting your own offices to make sure people are actually following the manual.
Let's talk about inspection frequencies.
Yeah.
Because this is heavily tested. Bunk has different types of offices. He has his main hub, which is an OSJ, an Office of Supervisory Jurisdiction. This is where he keeps the main trading desk where he makes markets, where Kathy sits and approves advertising. How often does Kathy have to inspect that OSJ?
OSJs and supervising branch offices, which are basically branches that supervise other smaller branches, they must be inspected annually, once a year, bare minimum.
What about a non-branch office? Let's say Dave has a tiny satellite office. He doesn't hold customer funds. He doesn't approve advertising. He just meets with clients and plays golf.
Non-branch locations must be inspected periodically, which Fenerad defines as at least every 3 years. So OSJs and supervising branches are annual. Non-branches are every 3 years.
Now, who actually does the inspecting? Can Dave just walk around his own satellite office, check some boxes on a clipboard, sign it, and mail it to Kathy?
Definitely not. Let's apply our framework here. Who is this rule designed to protect? It's protecting the customer from fraud. If Dave's entire compensation is based on generating revenue from that office, he has a massive conflict of interest. He's highly incentivized to ignore his own rule breaking. The rule dictates that inspections must be conducted by an independent person. You cannot inspect an office if you directly benefit from its revenues or if you report to the person who does.
Makes total sense. You can't grade your own homework. Now, this inspection process is just one part of what Fiara sees as a three-layer defensive fortress. Let's break down the stack. Layer one is what we just talked about, the basic supervisory system, the WSPs, the daily monitoring.
Right, and layer two goes deeper. It's internal supervisory controls. This is the firm testing its own system. Kathy has to design tests to figure out if her WSPs actually work in practice. Are the reviews happening? Are the red flags being caught? She writes a report on this for senior management.
And there is a specific financial threshold tied to this second layer, right?
Yes. If the firm generates gross revenues over $200 million, the regulators assume the risk is significantly higher. At that threshold, the firm must specifically test and verify its supervisory controls, not just assume they work.
Okay, so over 200 million means enhanced control testing. What is the third layer of the fortress?
The CEO's annual certification. The buck stops at the very top. Once a year, Bob, as the CEO, must sign a document certifying that the firm has processes in place to comply with all FINRA rules.
Can Bob just sign it blindly while playing golf?
He could, but he'd be committing fraud. The rule requires that his certification is backed up by two things. First, the firm must have conducted a compliance meeting with all registered personnel within the past 12 months. Second, the chief compliance officer must deliver a report to the board of directors within 45 days of the certification execution. Bob is essentially swearing that he has reviewed all this evidence.
Layer one is the system. Layer two is testing the system. Layer three is the CEO legally swearing it works. Now, what happens if the system is fine, but a literal hurricane destroys the OSJ? The building is totally underwater. This brings us to the BCP, the Business Continuity Plan.
Right. Every firm must create and maintain a written BCP identifying procedures relating to an emergency or significant business disruption. It has to cover data backup, alternate physical locations, and most importantly, how customers will be able to access their funds and securities if the firm's systems are completely down.
This is an exam trap call-out, listener. Fessin RA needs to know who to call when the hurricane hits. The question will ask, how many emergency contact persons must be listed on the BCP? Think about it.
The answer is exactly two. Not a minimum of two, not one, exactly two emergency contact persons. They must be associated persons of the firm, and at least one must be a member of senior management and a registered principal. Foreign RI wants two specific cell phone numbers they can dial when your office building is on fire.
Exactly two. Lock that in. All right, let's pivot to Devious Dave's favorite subject, conduct and anti-fraud. Dave is sitting on the trading desk trying to figure out how to maximize his commissions without going to jail. Let's talk about the bedrock of all securities law, the anti-fraud rule.
Rule 10b-5 under the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. It is incredibly broad. It prohibits any scheme, misstatement, omission of a material fact, or any fraudulent course of business. Basically, if you deceive a client to make a buck, you violated the anti-fraud rule.
And the penalties are not a slap on the wrist. If Dave gets caught running a fraudulent scheme, the individual criminal penalty is up to $5 million and 20 years in federal prison. And for Bob's firm, the entity penalty is up to $25 million.
That entity penalty is why Kathy doesn't sleep. Bob's firm would be vaporized by a $25 million fine.
Let's run some scenarios with Dave to see where the lines are. Direct question for the listener. Dave is trying to land a whale of a client. The client is nervous about a specific biotech stock. Can Dave say, look, I am so confident in this stock, I guarantee you won't lose money. If it drops, I will personally refund the difference to your account.
Never. Guaranteeing a customer against loss is a fundamental violation. You cannot pretend the market doesn't have risk. If you guarantee a trade, you are engaging in deceptive conduct.
Okay, so Dave can't guarantee it. What if he says, okay, how about this? You put up $100,000, I will actively trade it, and we will split the profits and the losses 50-50. Can Dave share an account with a client?
He can, but only if he clears some massive hurdles. First, he needs written approval from both the customer and from Bob's firm. Second, and this is the vital part, Dave's share of the profits and losses must be strictly proportionate to his actual financial contribution.
So if the client puts up $100,000 and Dave puts up $0 of his own money, Dave cannot take 50% of the profits.
Correct. If Dave contributes 10% of the capital, he can only take 10% of the profits, and he must bear 10% of any losses. The rule is designed to protect the customer from being exploited by a broker who wants the upside, but none of the skin in the game.
But wait, let's change the scenario. The client isn't a stranger. The client is Dave's mother. She gives him $100,000 of her retirement money to trade. Does the proportionality rule still apply?
This is a major exception. If the joint account is with an immediate family member, so parents, mother-in-law, spouse, children, the proportionality requirement is waived. Dave can split the profits 50-50 even if he didn't contribute a single dime.
But does he still need Kathy's permission?
Absolutely. The family exception waives the money math, but it never waives the firm's required prior written approval. Kathy still has to sign off on the account.
Got it. Let's move to insider trading. This is where people get Hollywood and reality confused. Let's set the scene. Dave is at a fancy country club. He is standing at the urinal, staring at the wall. The guy next to him is the CEO of a publicly traded tech company. The CEO is on his cell phone, loudly complaining to his lawyer that they are being acquired by Microsoft tomorrow for double their current stock price. Dave zips up, washes his hands, and realizes he now possesses material non-public information. He goes back to his trading desk. What happens next?
We have to clarify the aware versus use standard here. A lot of people, including some lawyers, used to argue that it's only insider trading if you actively use the information as the primary reason for making the trade. But the SEC standard is much stricter. It is trading while aware of material non-public information.
So if Dave buys 10,000 shares of that tech company at 1.00 p.m., he is guilty, even if he tries to tell the SEC, hey, I was planning on buying it anyway, I love their new software.
The SEC doesn't care. If you are aware of the information when you executed the trade, you are guilty. The only defense is if Dave had a pre-existing, legally binding plan.
Like a Rule 10b5-1 plan. Let's say 3 months ago, Dave set up an automated plan with his broker that explicitly said, buy 10,000 shares of this tech company on the third Tuesday of the month. He set it up when he knew nothing.
In that case, because the plan was prearranged before he became aware of the inside information and he had no discretion to change it, the trade executes legally. But he cannot alter the plan or initiate a new trade after overhearing the CEO.
Now let's look at Dave's relationship to the company. Dave isn't an employee of the tech firm. He isn't their banker. He literally just overheard a guy in a bathroom. He owes no fiduciary duty to that company. Can the SEC still charge him with insider trading?
Yes, under the misappropriation theory. Dave didn't stumble upon public information. He misappropriated. He essentially stole confidential information that did not belong to him, and he used it to gain an unfair advantage in the public markets.
This brings us to why Kathy is so stressed out all the time. If Dave gets caught insider trading, does the SEC only go after Dave? Or do they come for Bob and Kathy too?
They absolutely come for the firm. This is called controlling person liability. If the SEC determines that Bob's firm failed to establish, maintain, and enforce policies to prevent insider trading, the firm is held liable.
And the penalty is brutal. Treble damages.
Right. Treble means triple. The SEC can fine the firm up to 3 times the amount of profit Dave gained or the loss he avoided. If Dave made $1 million in illegal profit, Bob's firm can be fined $3 million. This is exactly why firms have intense information barriers, formerly known as Chinese walls, to stop sensitive information from crossing from the investment banking side over to the trading desk.
To protect the firm's capital from being vaporized by treble damages. Okay, let's take a breath and lighten the mood with a pattern interrupt. I have some genuinely fantastic news for anyone working in this industry. Thorin Ara finally updated the gift rule. Oh yeah, it was a long time coming. The old rule was notoriously, almost comically low. The old rule was a hard cap of $100 per person, per year. You couldn't even take a good client out to a nice dinner in Manhattan for $100. It was absurd. But Thorin Ara has officially raised it. The new limit is $300 per person per year. You can buy a client 3 decent steaks instead of 1.
It's a nice bump, but there is a massive trap here for the exam. How is that $300 calculated?
It is aggregated firm-wide. It is not $300 from Dave and another $300 from Bob. If Dave buys the client a $200 bottle of scotch in February and Bob wants to send that same client a holiday gift basket in December, Bob can only spend $100. The firm has to track every gift from every employee to make sure the aggregate doesn't exceed $300.
And remember the logic. Who is this rule protecting? It's protecting the integrity of the market from bribery. FINRA doesn't want brokers essentially buying business or influencing employees at other firms with lavish gifts.
What if Bob isn't giving gifts, but he wants to set up a referral system? Bob goes to the local community bank and says, hey, let me put a desk in your lobby. When your bank tellers see a customer with a lot of cash, they walk them over to me and I sell them mutual funds.
This is a networking arrangement. It is legal, but highly regulated because retail banking customers get very confused. They think because they are in a bank building, their mutual funds are FDIC insured against loss, which is, of course, false.
Right. FDIC covers bank deposits. SIPC covers broker-dealer failures. Neither covers market loss. So how does Bob set up his desk?
Physical separation. Bob's desk must be clearly physically separated from the area where retail deposits are taken. It has to have signage making it explicitly clear that he is a broker-dealer, not the bank.
And what about paying the bank tellers for the referrals? Can Bob give them 10% of the commission he makes on the trade?
Absolutely not. Bank tellers are not registered FINRA representatives. You cannot split commissions with unregistered persons. The only thing Bob can pay the teller is a one-time nominal referral fee. And that fee must be paid regardless of whether the customer actually opens an account or executes a trade. It's a flat fee just for walking them over to the desk.
One-time nominal fee. Nothing tied to the size of the trade. Speaking of paying unregistered people, what about an old broker who wants to retire? Let's say an older guy at Bob's firm built a huge book of mutual fund business over 30 years. He wants to move to Florida and drop his FINRA registration. Can Bob keep paying him the trailing commissions on those old accounts?
Usually the moment you drop your license, you cannot receive commissions. But there is a specific exception for retiring reps. Bob can pay him continuing commissions, but only if there is a bona fide written contract in place prior to the rep retiring.
If the guy retires on Friday, moves to Florida, and calls Bob on Monday asking for his cut, it is too late. The contract must be signed while he is still registered.
Exactly. It's a clean break with a prearranged trail.
Okay, let's move to product supervision. Bob's firm is getting pitched by a wholesaler to start selling a brand new, incredibly complex, collateralized debt obligation. It yields 12%. And nobody really understands how it works. Can Dave just start calling clients and pitching it?
No. That FINRA requires a rigorous review of new products. Before anyone can sell it, the firm must have a documented committee review the product. The committee has to dig into the prospectus, understand the risks, and make a formal decision to approve it.
This establishes what's called reasonable basis suitability, right?
Yes. The firm is basically saying, we have investigated this and we believe it is a suitable investment for at least some subset of investors. Once it clears the committee, Dave still has to determine if it's suitable for his specific customer, but the firm has to clear the first hurdle.
And some products have their own specific regulatory speed bumps, like variable annuities. If Dave sells a deferred variable annuity, the paperwork doesn't just go straight to the insurance company.
Variable annuities have a history of abusive sales practices, mostly because they pay massive commissions and lock the client's money up for years with surrender charges. So FINRA mandates that a registered principal must review and approve the application within 7 business days before it can be sent to the issuer. Kathy has to look at it and say, did Dave just sell a 10-year lockup product to an 85-year-old woman who needs cash for medical bills? If so, she rejects it.
7 business days for principal review. Now, I promised you, the listener, that we wouldn't just speed read textbook rules at you, but there are 3 major regulatory acts that always get jumbled together on the exam. Let's slow down and look at the underlying logic of each one. First, the Investment Company Act of 1940. Specifically, what makes a mutual fund diversified?
This is the 75-5-10 rule. Let's walk through the math. To call itself a diversified management company, the fund must meet these thresholds. First, at least 75% of the fund's total assets must be invested in a diversified manner. The remaining 25% can be concentrated however they want.
Okay, so let's look at that 75% chunk. What are the rules inside that bucket?
Within that 75% bucket, the fund cannot invest more than 5% of its total assets in any one single issuer. And the fund cannot own more than 10% of the outstanding voting stock of any single issuer.
Let me translate that to plain English for a second. The 5% rule protects the fund from a single company going bankrupt. If the fund puts 50% of its money into Enron and Enron goes to zero, the fund is destroyed. Capping it at 5% limits the downside. The 10% voting stock rule prevents the mutual fund from becoming a massive corporate raider that takes over companies.
Exactly. It forces them to be passive investors, not hostile acquirers. 75-5-10.
Next major rule, Regulation A. This is the mini IPO exemption.
Reg A is designed for smaller companies that want to raise capital from the public, but they just can't afford the massive legal and accounting fees of a full S1 IPO registration. It comes in 2 tiers.
The numbers to memorize are $20 million and $75 million. Tier 1 allows a company to raise up to $20 million in a 12-month period. Tier 2 allows up to $75 million.
And why do we care about the tiers? Because Tier 2, the larger one, requires the company to provide audited financial statements, while Tier 1 does not. More money raised equals more SEC scrutiny.
Last one in this section, the Trust Indenture Act of 1939. This was born out of the Great Depression, right?
Yes. During the Depression, massive corporations were defaulting on their bonds. The individual bondholders, like everyday people, had no leverage to fight these huge companies in bankruptcy court to get their money back. So Congress passed the Trust Indenture Act.
It mandates that if a corporation issues public debt over $10 million, they must appoint a formal independent trustee, usually a bank.
Yeah.
The trustee's only job is to advocate for the bondholders if the corporation defaults.
But the crucial exam trap here is who it applies to. It applies to public corporate debt over $10 million. It does not apply to U.S. government bonds. It does not apply to municipal bonds, just corporate debt.
Okay, let's talk about what happens when things go wrong and clients get angry. Disputes. If a client calls Dave on the phone, screaming that he lost their money, does Kathy have to log that in a formal file?
No. Avara defines a formal customer complaint as a written grievance. It can be a letter, an email, or a text message. But an angry phone call doesn't trigger the rule.
But if they send an angry email, Kathy has to keep it. For how long?
Customer complaints must be retained at the Office of Supervisory Jurisdiction for a minimum of 4 years.
4 years. But keeping the email in a folder is one thing. What if the complaint accuses Dave of outright stealing money from the account? Or forging the client's signature.
That escalates it from a basic complaint to a reportable event. Kathy must file a specific disclosure with FINRA within 30 days of discovering it.
And what if it's not theft, but just a massive lawsuit over a bad recommendation that Bob's firm decides to settle out of court?
Settlements also trigger the 30-day reporting requirement, but only if they cross certain financial thresholds. If they settle a claim against a registered rep like Dave for more than $15,000, Kathy has 30 days to report it. If the settlement is against the firm itself, the threshold is $25,000.
Over $15,000 for the rep. Over $25,000 for the firm. Now, how do these disputes actually get settled? The exam will try to trick you on the difference between arbitration and mediation. Let's look at the mechanics. If a customer is furious and demands arbitration, can Bob's firm say, "No, thanks, we'd rather go to federal court"?
No. Arbitration is a non-waivable industry mandate. When a customer opens an account, there is an arbitration agreement. If the customer demands it, the firm must participate. It is a unilateral right of the customer.
And what happens when the arbitration panel makes a decision? Let's say they order Bob to pay the client $100,000. Can Bob appeal to a higher court?
No. Arbitration is binding and final. There is virtually no appeal process, even if you think the arbitrator's made a mistake. You pay the award within 30 days, or Fillon O'Reilly suspends your license.
Now contrast that with mediation.
Mediation is a completely voluntary process where an independent third party tries to help the two sides negotiate a settlement. Both sides have to agree to enter mediation. And more importantly, it is non-binding. If the mediator suggests Bob pay $50,000 and Bob refuses, he just walks away.
Arbitration is forced and binding. Mediation is voluntary and non-binding.
Got it. Now let's talk about Kathy's filing cabinets. Books and records. Every single document in a broker-dealer has a legally mandated lifespan. Let's look at the retention ladder.
The default rule for the majority of broker-dealer records, particularly customer account information, is 6 years. You must keep the account opening documents and statements for 6 years after the account is officially closed.
So accounts are 6 years. We just established that written customer complaints are 4 years. Why the difference?
It generally ties back to statutes of limitation. Arbitration claims typically have a 6-year window. Customer complaints are tracked heavily by fine and R examiners who operate on different audit cycles. The regulators want complaints highly visible for 4 years. And what's at the bottom of the ladder?
The 3-year bucket. This applies to most other communications, including authorizations to negotiate instruments, trial balances, and general correspondence. So the ladder to memorize is 6, 4, and 3. And crucially, for almost all of these, the records must be kept in an easily accessible place, meaning the physical office or immediate digital retrieval for the first 2 years.
6 for accounts, 4 for complaints, 3 for other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Easily accessible for the first two. Now, I want to talk about one of the most fascinating regulatory mechanics on the exam, the taping rule.
F. Fine Ray Rule 3170. It was created in response to the era of boiler rooms, like the Wolf of Wall Street style firms that aggressively cold called and scammed retail investors. Fine Ray would eventually shut those firms down.
But the brokers who worked at those boiler rooms didn't just quit finance. They just walked across the street and got hired at a new firm.
Exactly. It's called the cockroach theory. When you turn on the lights at a dirty firm and shut it down, the bad brokers just scatter to other firms. Fine Ray realized they needed a way to track these people. So they created the taping rule. Fine Art looks at the historical background of every single person Bob hires.
If Bob starts hiring a bunch of brokers who were previously fired or came from firms that Fine Art expelled, his firm's risk profile skyrockets.
If Bob hits a specific percentage threshold of these disciplined reps, he triggers the rule. For a large firm, it's 20% of the sales force. If 20% of your staff came from expelled firms, Fine Art sends a letter.
The letter basically says, "We don't trust the people you hired. You must now install recording equipment and tape record every single telephone conversation between your reps and your customers and keep those tapes for 3 years."
It is wildly expensive and it is a massive reputational stain. Bob desperately wants to avoid this. Does he have a way out once he gets the letter?
Yes, the cure window. Bob has a one-time 30-day period to adjust his staff. He can literally fire the disciplined reps to get his percentage back under the 20% threshold. If he does that, he avoids the taping. If he fails, the recorders turn on.
Let's transition to the math that keeps the doors open. Net capital and margin. Net capital is the firm's liquid lifeblood. It proves to the SEC that the firm has enough cash to survive a bad day in the market. The required minimum scale with the firm's risk.
Let's build the ladder. What is the most risky type of firm?
A carrying firm, also known as a clearing firm. They physically hold customer cash and securities in their own vaults. Because they have custody of the assets, the risk of loss or theft is highest. They require a minimum net capital of $250,000.
$250K. What if Bob runs an introducing firm? He talks to the clients, he takes the orders, but he immediately routes them to a massive clearing firm like Pershing or Schwab to handle the actual custody. Bob's vault is totally empty.
Much lower risk. An introducing firm that occasionally receives customer funds but passes them on needs $50,000. If they don't even receive customer funds at all, they just introduce the account, it drops to $5,000.
What about the firms making markets on the exchange?
Market makers who provide liquidity by standing ready to buy and sell all day need a gap line of $100,000.
And the titans of Wall Street, the prime brokers who service massive hedge funds.
Prime brokers require $1 million in net capital. So the latter is 250K carrying, 100K market maker, 50K introducing, 5K non-receiving introducing.
Okay, that's the firm's capital. What about the customer's capital? Let's talk margin. This is when Dave tells a client to borrow money from the firm to buy more stock than they can afford. There is a massive exam trap call out here regarding who sets the rules.
The exam will test your understanding of Regulation T versus final raw maintenance rules. Regulation T is established by the Federal Reserve Board. It controls the initial extension of credit.
The moment the trade happens.
Right. Reg T says the initial margin requirement is 50%. If Dave's client wants to buy $100,000 of Tesla stock on margin, the client must deposit at least $50,000 of their own cash. The firm loans them the other $50,000.
Reg T is initial.
Yeah.
50%. It also has a penalty rule for cash accounts.
Yes. If a customer buys a stock in a cash account, no borrowing allowed, and they fail to pay for it within the T+2 settlement window plus the 2-day grace period, the firm must sell out the position and freeze the account for 90 days.
90-day freeze for deadbeats. So that's the Federal Reserve setting the initial 50%. When does FINRA step in?
FINRA cares about what happens after the trade. The market moves. If Tesla stock drops by 40%, the value of the account plunges, but the client still owes the firm that $50,000 loan. This threatens the firm's capital. So FINRA sets the maintenance margin.
This is the trigger for a margin call.
MRR requires the customer to maintain at least 25% equity in a long margin account. If the equity drops below 25%, the firm issues a margin call, demanding the client deposit more cash immediately. For short margin accounts, where the risk is theoretically infinite, the maintenance requirement is higher. 30%.
Initial is 50%. Reg T maintenance is 25% long, 30% short, fan and aura. What about Dave's hyperactive clients, the ones trading in and out of stock 6 times a day?
They get flagged as pattern day traders. If a customer executes 4 or more day trades within 5 business days, they are a PTT. Because day trading is so risky, FINRA imposes a strict minimum equity floor of $25,000. If the account drops to $24,999, they are restricted from day trading.
$25,000 floor for the PDTs. Take a deep breath. We have crushed Function 1 and Function 2. We've built the firm. We supervise the maniacs. Now we move to Part 3, the front lines. Customer-related activities, Function 3.
This is where we interact with the public, account opening, anti-money laundering, and making recommendations.
Let's start with AML. Anti-money laundering. We are looking for criminals trying to wash dirty money through Bob's broker-dealer. The exam tests 2 primary reports under the Bank Secrecy Act. Let's look at the mechanics of the CTR versus the SAR.
The CTR is the currency transaction report. I want you to think of this as a purely objective tripwire. It has nothing to do with whether the client looks suspicious. It is triggered by cold, hard math.
Let's say Dave has a client who walks into the branch carrying a literal duffel bag filled with crumpled $20 bills. He dumps it on the desk. It totals $12,000 in physical cash, and he wants to deposit it.
Physical currency over $10,000 in a single business day triggers the CTR. It's objective. Even if the client is the town mayor and Dave trusts him completely, the duffel bag of cash over $10K means Kathy must file the CTR.
Yeah, when is the CTR due to the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, FinCEN?
The CTR is due within 15 days of the transaction.
Okay, objective, 10K physical cash, 15 days. Now, what is the SAR?
The SAR is the suspicious activity report. This is subjective. It requires Dave or Kathy to use their brain and say, something feels wrong here. The financial threshold is much lower, $5,000 or more.
Give me a scenario where Dave files a SAR, but not a CTR.
Dave's client wires in $8,000 from a bank in a high-risk offshore jurisdiction. 2 days later, he uses that money to buy highly illiquid penny stocks, takes a massive loss, and immediately requests that the remaining $3,000 be wired to a different bank in a different country. There is no physical cash, so no CTR. It's under $10,000 anyway. But economically, it makes zero sense. It looks like he is washing the money through the market. Dave gets suspicious.
So the suspicion of illicit activity over $5,000 triggers the SAR. When is Kathy required to file it?
The SAR is due within 30 days of discovering the suspicious activity.
Exam trap call out right here. Listen closely. Dave files the SAR on his sketchy client. Dave likes this client. They play golf together. Dave calls him up and says, hey, man. just a heads up. Kathy made me file a suspicious activity report on your account, so maybe don't do any more weird wire transfers for a bit.
Dave just committed a federal crime. SARs are strictly, absolutely confidential. Tipping off the subject of a SAR is a severe criminal offense. You cannot even acknowledge to the client that a SAR exists. If they ask why their wire is delayed, you give a generic administrative excuse. You never mention FinCEN.
Do not tip off the money launderers. Okay, let's look at a different way Dave gets himself in trouble. Twitter, communications with the public. Fenton Arroway cares deeply about what brokers say on the internet. We are going to sort every communication using the 25-30 rule. Direct question to you, the listener. Dave is on his public Twitter account. He posts a meme showing a rocket ship next to a biotech stock ticker. He has 5,000 followers. Which regulatory category does this tweet fall into? Give it a beat.
To figure it out, you follow a flowchart. First question, is this communication going solely to institutional investors, banks, hedge funds, people with over $50 million.
No, it's public Twitter. Anyone can see it.
Right. So it's not institutional communication. That leaves two options, correspondence or retail communication. The dividing line between those two is the number 25.
If the communication is distributed to 25 or fewer retail investors within any 30 calendar day period, it is correspondence. Think of an email Dave sends to 10 of his best clients.
But if it is distributed to more than 25 retail investors within a 30-day period, it crosses the threshold. It becomes a retail communication. Since Dave has 5,000 followers and the tweet is public, it is definitely a retail communication.
And why does Kathy care about this label? Does it change her workload?
It changes everything. Correspondence only requires supervisory review. Kathy can review Dave's emails after he sends them, usually by randomly sampling a percentage of them based on her WSPs. But a retail communication requires PRE use principle approval.
Meaning Dave cannot hit post on that rocket ship meme until Kathy explicitly approves it.
Exactly. And furthermore, most retail communications must be filed with FINR's advertising department within 10 business days of first use. So a public tweet creates a massive compliance burden.
Let's talk about the actual advice Dave is giving. When Dave recommends a stock to a client, what legal standard is he held to? The industry just went through a massive paradigm shift here. Let's look at the history of suitability versus Reg BI.
For decades, the standard was suitability. This basically meant Dave could recommend a product as long as it wasn't outright terrible for the client based on their age, income, and risk tolerance.
The problem was, if Dave had two mutual funds that were both technically suitable for a retiree, but Fund A paid Dave a massive commission and charged the client high hidden fees while Fund B was cheap, well, Dave could legally recommend Fund A. He was allowed to put his own commission ahead of the client's return, as long as it wasn't unsuitable.
Exactly. Public outrage over this conflict of interest led the SEC to implement Regulation Best Interest, or Reg BI. This is a much stricter standard that applies exclusively to retail customers.
Under Reg BI, Dave must act in the best interest of the retail customer at the time the recommendation is made, without placing his own financial interest ahead of the customer's.
It forces Dave to consider the actual cost of the investment. He has to prove that the higher fee product is genuinely better for the client, not just better for his wallet. Reg BI has four specific obligations: disclosure, care, conflict of interest, and compliance.
So Reg BI covers retail. Does suitability still exist?
Yes, suitability still primarily governs recommendations made to institutional investors who are assumed to be sophisticated enough to negotiate their own fees and understand the conflicts.
And when Bob's firm actually executes a trade for a retail client, out of their own inventory acting as a dealer, how much markup can they legally charge?
They are governed by FINRA's 5% policy. It is a guideline, not a rigid rule. It states that markups, markdowns, and commissions must be fair and reasonable and generally should not exceed 5%.
But 5% isn't a safe harbor. If Bob charges 4% on a highly liquid S&P 500 stock, FINRA will still hammer him because it should only cost pennies to trade that. But if he charges 5.5% on an incredibly rare, illiquid municipal bond that took him 3 days to locate, FINRA might say that's fair.
Exactly. It's a guideline based on the difficulty of the trade, but 5% is the benchmark in your head.
Awesome. Part three is down. Now we enter part four, the Wild West, trading and market making, function four. This is where the math gets tight and the timelines get incredibly fast. Let's start with short selling. Bob hates a specific company. He thinks their earnings are fake. He wants to short the stock, meaning he wants to borrow shares he doesn't own, sell them in the market, and buy them back later at a lower price to pocket the difference.
Short selling is heavily regulated under Regulation SHO. The SEC created Reg SHO because of naked short selling. Before this rule, traders would short stocks without ever bothering to actually find the shares to borrow. They would just flood the market with phantom sell orders, driving the price into the ground.
So how does Reg SHO stop that?
With the locate requirement. Before Bob can even enter the short sale order into his terminal, he must have a documented locate. He has to affirmatively find the shares from a lending desk or have reasonable documented grounds to believe he can borrow them by the settlement date. No locate, no short sale.
But let's say Bob gets a locate, executes the short sale, but when settlement day comes, the lending desk says, oops, we actually don't have those shares to give you.
Yep.
Bob has now failed to deliver the shares to the buyer. This is a fail. Let's look at the timeline to fix it.
Under Reg SHO, if there is a fail to deliver on a short sale, Bob's firm must close out that fail immediately. They have to go into the open market and buy the securities by the morning of T plus one, the trading day, following the settlement date.
T plus one for a short fail. What if the scenario is different? Dave sells shares of Apple that he actually owns. It's a long sale. But the shares are physical paper certificates sitting in a safe deposit box. And Dave loses the key. He fails to deliver on settlement day.
Long fails are treated slightly more leniently because the trader actually owns the asset. They are just having administrative issues. Long fails must be closed out by T plus three. So memorize that. Short fails closed by T plus one. Long fails closed by T plus three.
We also have market safeguards to prevent flash crashes. If Bob is shorting a stock and it starts dropping like a stone, there is a speed bump called the alternative uptick rule.
If a stock experiences a 10% intraday drop from the previous day's closing price, the alternative uptick rule triggers automatically. For the rest of that day and the entire next trading day, short selling is restricted. You can only execute a short sale at a price above the current national best bid. It prevents short sellers from aggressively hammering a falling stock.
And what if it's not just one stock? What if the entire market is crashing because of a global news event? We have market-wide circuit breakers based on the S&P 500 index.
The thresholds are 7%, 13%, and 20%. If the S&P drops 7%, trading halts for 15 minutes. If it drops 13%, it halts again. If it hits 20%, the market closes for the rest of the day.
Let's move off the exchange floor and into the back office, settlement and clearance. When Bob's firm trades over the counter with another broker-dealer, they are governed by the Uniform Practice Code, the UPC.
The UPC is the street-side rulebook. It standardizes how firms deal with each other so the plumbing of the financial system doesn't clog. It dictates delivery, settlement, and closeouts. But note the exceptions. It does not apply to municipal bonds, and it does not apply to U.S. government securities.
When do regular wage trades for corporate stocks and bonds settle under the UPC?
T plus one, the next business day after the trade day. If Dave buys a stock on Tuesday, the cash and the shares must exchange hands on Wednesday.
Now, let's look at bond math. When you buy a bond in between its semi-annual coupon payments, you have to compensate the seller for the interest that accrued while they held it. How do we count the days?
It depends entirely on the type of bond. For corporate bonds and municipal bonds, we use a 3360 day count convention. We artificially pretend that every single month has exactly 30 days and the year has exactly 360 days. It makes the fractional math much simpler for the back office.
But for U.S. government bonds?
The U.S. government uses actual. You count the exact actual number of days in that specific month and the actual 365 days in the year.
Right. The U.S. Treasury is far too precise to pretend that February has 30 days. Corporate is 3360. Government is actual. Now, I want to unpack trade reporting. The outline calls this a speed round, but I think it's vital to understand where these reports go. Bob executes an off-exchange trade. The public needs to know the price so the market is transparent. Where does Bob send the data?
If it's a national market system, like a stock listed on the New York Stock Exchange, but Bob traded it off exchange, he reports it to the trade reporting facility, the TRF. The deadline is 10 seconds.
10 seconds. If it's an OTC equity, like an unlisted penny stock,
that goes to the OTC reporting facility, the ORF, also within 10 seconds.
If it's a corporate bond,
bonds go to TRACE. The deadline is 15 minutes. Bond markets move slower than equity markets.
Now, I want to dive deep into the final reporting system,
mm-hmm.
the Consolidated Audit Trail, or CIT. Why does this exist?
To understand CIT, you have to remember the flash crash of 2010. The stock market mysteriously plunged 1,000 points in minutes and then rebounded. The SEC tried to investigate why it happened, but they couldn't. The data was too fragmented across dozens of different exchanges and dark pools. They couldn't piece the timeline together.
So they mandated the CIAT. The SEAD tracks the entire life cycle of an order, from the moment Dave receives it from the client, to routing it, to modifying it, to final execution. Every single step is logged.
The reports are due to the SEAD system by 8 a.m. Eastern Time on T+1. But here's the most testable detail. To ensure the SEC can recreate a flash crash perfectly, they need the timestamps to line up across every firm on Wall Street. Firms must synchronize their computer business clocks to within 50 milliseconds of the national time standard.
50 milliseconds. If Dave's computer clock is a tenth of a second off, Kathy is getting a compliance violation. That brings us to our final function. Part 5, the big leagues, investment banking and research. Function 5.
This is where the massive money is made, bringing new companies to the public markets.
Let's set the narrative. Bob's firm is stepping up. They are underwriting an initial public offering, an IPO, for Devious Dave's new, highly questionable business. Devious Dave's Doggy Daycare, Inc. We have to walk through the timeline of taking this company public under the Securities Act of 1933. It happens in three distinct phases.
Phase 1 is the pre-filing period. Dave and Bob are figuring out the valuation and drafting the registration statement, the S-1. The absolute rule during this period is no offers. You cannot hype the stock, you cannot solicit orders, you cannot publish research reports.
This is known as gun jumping. If Bob goes on CNBC and says Dave's Doggy Daycare is going to be the hottest IPO of the year, before the S-1 is filed, the SEC will halt the IPO entirely.
They stay quiet and they file the S-1. Now we enter phase 2, the waiting period, also known as the cooling off period, which lasts a minimum of 20 days.
What can Bob do now? The document is filed, but not approved.
During the waiting period, Bob can make oral offers. He can call his institutional clients and gauge their interest. He can distribute a preliminary prospectus known as a red herring. It has a red border on the cover stating that the information is not complete and the price isn't finalized.
But, and this is crucial, no sales can occur. Bob can take indications of interest, which are non-binding, but he cannot accept a check. He cannot finalize a trade.
Pre-filing, no offers, waiting period, oral offers, red herrings, no sales. Then we hit phase 3, post-effective. The SEC reviews the paperwork, finds no glaring omissions, and declares the registration effective.
Sales begin, and the final prospectus with the actual public offering price must be delivered to investors.
But physical delivery is mostly obsolete. The rule is access equals delivery. As long as the final prospectus is filed on the SEC's EDGAR website where the public can download it, the delivery requirement is satisfied.
Let me hit you with an exam trap call out regarding that paperwork. The S-1 prospectus has to be entirely truthful. But what if Dave lies on it? What if he inflates the revenue of the doggy daycare by $10 million and the stock crashes when the truth comes out? The investors will sue everyone. Can Bob's firm, the underwriters, avoid liability?
Yes, through the due diligence defense. Bob's firm can argue, we were deceived too. We conducted a reasonable professional investigation into Dave's finances, and we honestly believed the numbers were true. If the court agrees their diligence was reasonable, the underwriter is protected.
But what about Dave, the issuer?
The issuer never gets the due diligence defense. It is Dave's company. He is strictly liable for the contents of the prospectus. If the paperwork is materially false, the issuer is on the hook no matter what.
Love it. Now, what if Dave decides an IPO is too much scrutiny? He doesn't want the SEC digging through his doggy daycare books. He wants to raise capital privately. Let's look at his options, the exemptions.
The most common exemption is Regulation D. This allows Dave to raise an unlimited amount of money through a private placement. He can sell shares to an unlimited number of accredited investors, institutions, and wealthy individuals with a net worth over $1 million, excluding their primary residence.
But can he sell to regular, non-wealthy people?
Only a very small amount. Reggie caps the offering at a maximum of 35 non-accredited investors, and Bob's firm has to file a Form D with the SEC within 15 days of the first sale just to notify them it happened.
So Reg D is domestic private money. What if Dave wants to sell shares exclusively to foreign investors in Europe to avoid U.S. registration?
That is, Regulation SS stands for offshore. It exempts offerings made entirely outside the U.S. borders to non-U.S. residents.
Okay, we have one final massive topic to cover. The Chinese wall between research and investment banking. This is all about eliminating extreme conflicts of interest.
Imagine if Bob's firm is making $5 million in investment banking fees to take Dave's company public. Bob has a massive financial incentive to make sure the IPO is a success. If Bob's firm also employs research analysts who publish buy or sell ratings on stocks, there is a huge temptation for Bob to pressure those analysts into writing a glowing, strong buy report on Dave's company to pump up the IPO.
This exact scenario caused massive scandals in the early 2000s. Retail investors were buying garbage stocks because analysts were secretly being pressured by their banking bosses to pump them up. So Fenerob built a wall.
A research report is defined as any written analysis of an equity security that provides enough information to base an investment decision on. The moment a communication crosses that line, it must be completely walled off from the investment banking department.
Direct question to the listener. Let's say Bob the banker wants to read a draft of the research report on Dave's company before it gets published. He promises he just wants to fact check it and make sure the analyst's conclusions are solid. Can he read it?
Absolutely not. Investment banking cannot review research reports for their conclusions, their ratings, or their price targets prior to publication. They are only allowed to check them for verifiable factual accuracy, like confirming a public revenue number. And even then, it usually has to be routed through legal. They cannot influence the rating.
Can Bob pay the analyst a massive bonus because the positive report helped the IPO succeed?
No banking-driven pay. A research analyst's compensation must be determined by a committee that explicitly excludes investment banking personnel.
Who actually approves a report for publication, then?
Every research report must get approved by a supervisory analyst, which requires passing a specific, specialized exam, the Series 16.
And Fenerob imposes quiet periods to prevent hype around an IPO.
Right. If a firm acted as the manager or co-manager of an IPO, their analysts must stay off the air. They cannot publish any research reports or make public appearances regarding that company for 10 calendar days after the IPO. If it was a secondary offering, the quiet period is 3 days.
10 days for IPO, 3 days for secondary, unless it is an emerging growth company under the JOBS Act, which exempts them from the quiet period to encourage coverage. We did it. We made it through all five functions. Now, I promised our listeners with ADHD that we would tie a bow on this. It is time for the rapid-fire recap of the most highly testable numbers. Ready?
Let's lock them in.
The forms. U4 to hire, 10 days to amend for a statutory disqualification. U5 to fire, 30 days to file. Form BD to build a firm, BDW to withdraw.
The money limits.
SIPC covers up to $500,000 for firm failure, never market loss. The gift limit is $300 aggregated per year. CGR for physical cash over $10,000. SAR for suspicious activity over $5,000.
Keep customer complaints for 4 years. Keep customer account info for 6 years. Report equity trades to the TRF in 10 seconds. Report debt trades to Trace in 15 minutes.
Boom. If you can hold those facts in your head and remember the logic behind them, you are going to pick up a massive amount of free points on exam day. We have covered a mountain of material today. But I want to leave you with a final provocative thought, a framework for when you are sitting in that testing center, the clock is ticking, and you are staring at a completely confusing multiple choice question about a rule you don't remember studying.
When that panic sets in, take a breath. Step back and ask yourself one simple question. Who is this specific rule designed to protect? Is it designed to protect the integrity of the overall market, like the CIT reporting system or the alternative uptick rule? Is it designed to protect the retail customer's wallet, like Reg BI or the ban on guarantees? Or is it designed to protect the firm's capital from being wiped out, like net capital requirements or margin maintenance calls? Once you can identify the victim that the rule is trying to save, the underlying logic of the regulation reveals itself. And when you know the logic, the right multiple choice answer will usually light up like a neon sign.
Find the victim, find the answer. It's a brilliant framework. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the Series 24. We know this material is dense, but you've got this. Keep hammering those concepts, remember the traps, and good luck conquering your exam. We will see you on the other side.